ask any questions that you might have about concentration practice. And it's a time you can have an interview. You can kind of put it all out there. Just a few people will hear what you have to say, but say how it's going with the concentration practice, or questions you have, or questions you might have about how to continue with this beyond tonight, beyond the series, or anything. Yeah.
Okay. How do we continue with this?
Well, that's a good open question, but that'll be part of the class, too. So I think we'll wait for the class.
So I have a question about, you know, as you go forward, then how do you make a judgment in your intent on a particular setting in the combination of concentration meditation and insight meditation? And how would you recommend that we vary those in a sort of a productive way? Or is that individualism or something?
So the question is, how would you decide when to do concentration practice and when to focus more on vipassana?
Right.
And well, that's a good question. I don't have any simple guideline or rule for that. I think when the mind is distracted and easily scattered and kind of gets lost in thought a lot, then it usually it can often be very useful to do concentration practice. I often do it at that point. Sometimes if there's been a lot, until the mind is stabilized, that's a classic function of concentration, is to stabilize the mind so you can do vipassana. And but sometimes it's more, I find more useful if I'm in a distracted state to do vipassana on that state. To do vipassana mindfulness on that state. Because it's very interesting to kind of see what's really going on there and to deal with it. Whereas in concentration, you're not dealing with anything. Concentration, you're just calming things down.
Right.
Whereas in vipassana, with mindfulness, you'd be actually kind of looking at, what's actually happening in that state. So if you're distracted, for example, because you're worried you might get a speeding ticket driving home from the center, then so you might calm that down, through concentration practice, or you might look at your mind and say, well, why are you planning to drive fast even before you get in your car? And, reflect on that and change, that's a silly example, but... So you have to decide what is most useful. And so you have to kind of, so if you have a little bit of experience in both, then you have some criteria that helps you decide which is most useful, because you know what the consequences would be.
Right. Do you mix these up within a particular setting? So if you're setting down to a 45-minute setting, do you sort of say, all right, I'm going to really focus on concentration, or I'm really going to focus on, or do you just let it flow?
That's a good question. Sometimes I'll choose to do one or the other. Sometimes I'll choose to do some concentration practice first for a while, very specifically to do that. But the way I do vipassana practice is very breath-centered. And the breath also functions breath meditation has a double function. It can be mindfulness and it can be concentrating. You can get concentrated in doing mindfulness. You don't have to see these two things as being so separate either. So sometimes I'm sitting down, I'm distracted. I'll just do vipassana on the breath, do mindfulness of breathing, and that'll help calm me and settle me a little bit, and then just continue doing the mindfulness. And sometimes I'll switch, and be very particularly focusing on the breath in a much more narrow, kind of simple way than I would during doing vipassana. In meditation practice, it's best to think of yourself as being the teacher. And you're discovering how to find your way by trial and error. So you try something. You try doing something for a little while and seeing how that helps you, how it supports you, or how it doesn't. Mm-hmm. And you might find certain situations it's really helpful to do some concentration practice. And then you might find that you do a lot of concentration practice, and after a while it doesn't seem to be helping. It doesn't really help you get down to really deal with some of the things you need to deal with. So then you switch over, and trial and error, you kind of find your way. Mm-hmm.
Also, one other comment. I found that the instruction that you gave in vis-a-vis the sort of the forgiveness little like a loving kindness meditation at the beginning of one, and then the loving kindness meditation really settles me into being very able to go into concentration meditation in a very simple, easy way, because it really lets go of so much when you do that process of that forgiveness, and then do the loving kindness, and then you know, 5-10 minutes later, you're really can go into
great, beautiful,
really nice concentration in a simple, easy way.
Nice. So one of the classic one classic way of doing a meditation session is you actually divide it up into different parts and do different practices as you go along. And one of the you might start, for example, by doing a couple of different practices, like loving-kindness meditation might be one that you might do, or you might do some recollection of the Buddha, something that brings you, inspires your faith or helps you let go of things. You might contemplate death. That kind of helps some people let go of a lot of different things. And then kind of starting that way then sets the, you know, kind of helps you settle you much more quickly sometimes than just concentrating on the breath. And loving-kindness practice has the added function that it brings on this, for some people it's very helpful because it kind of attunes the heart into be in a mood that's more favorable for meditation.
I can count and think at the same time.
You can count and think at the same time. Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's very important to see that and recognize that that's happening. You can expect that to happen. Sooner or later, the counting will become mechanical. And then as soon as you notice that, that's your cue that you have to reinvigorate it with life. And so you take whatever is your life force, whatever is your kind of vital kind of attention, and pour it back into the breath. Because your vital attention is kind of being lost or into your thoughts. And so you don't necessarily have to stop thinking. If you can, great. If you can't, but you want to take your kind of center of gravity of your attention to your counting or to the actual breath itself. So the breath and the counting become the place where it's more organic, more alive. And so there has to be kind of a turning of that vitality into the breath. And a lot of that involves just paying more careful attention to the breath, really taking an interest in the breath.
When I naturally breathe, I don't have a heavy breath. Like I forget to. I feel like I forget to breathe at times. Like I'm breathing, but I don't hear it. When I'm doing meditation, I feel like I have to breathe heavy so I can hear it, so I can count it.
Oh, so you're relying on the hearing of it to notice your breathing?
Like feeling it, like you know, you get, you know, I can feel it doing it deeper.
Right.
And then I can concentrate easier.
Right. Some people I know some people that do that. It is helpful sometimes for concentration to breathe a little more fully or deeply. Some sooner or later you have to let go of that extra effort, because that extra effort gets in the way of the stilling, the quieting that happens in concentration practice. What you want to try to do is try to develop a greater sensitivity to your breathing, sensing the physical sensations connected to your breathing. What part of your body do you usually feel the breath? If you're breathing heavily.
Yeah.
But if you're breathing really subtle, do you feel it in your chest?
Yeah, I don't know where I feel it. I think my nose. It's really subtle.
Uh-huh. It gets more and more subtle. So when the mind gets really concentrated, it can get very, very subtle, and you have to apply a little bit extra effort to kind of stay with it or find it. And sometimes it can just be a very, very slight sense of movement or pressure or a little bit of, you know, heaviness or something that you might feel there. And you just want to hang in there and hang in there and hang in there the best you can. And, I mean, it might not feel like your regular kind of breathing. And sometimes the breath, the sensations of breathing or the breathing seem to stop entirely. And then there's other instructions on what to do.
Can you give us an example of the difference between watching the breath in Vipassana and watching the breath in concentration?
So the difference between watching the breath in Vipassana and watching it in concentration. There's an analogy that might help. If you're in a snowstorm and you're watching the snow falling, you see, you know, you're looking out the window and the snow is falling, and if you're, you're kind of watching the flow of the snow fall, going down, that's more like concentration. If you're picking up each individual snow flake as it's coming down and really getting to know it, seeing, you know, that in fact no two snowflakes are the same, you know, you're sort of really there for each snowflake, that's more Vipassana.
So when I practice concentration, if my concentration wavers, the way that I bring it back is to be more attentive to the way the breath feels.
Sure.
And I don't really get a sense that I'm doing Vipassana. I really feel like I'm now concentrating on the movement of my abdomen up and down or whatever it happens to be. And I'll notice that if I've drifted or something, that I've actually drifted away from the sensation, mm-hmm. and that all I try to do is just come back to the sensation of the feeling.
That sounds great to me.
This is concentration, or is this Vipassana?
It might be a little bit of both. I wouldn't worry about it too much. You know, it's fine. You know, just, you know, you can develop your concentration. You can develop concentration doing mindfulness. And you can get very strongly concentrated doing mindfulness of the breathing. So if you find it helpful to develop concentration by getting a little more interested in what's actually happening with the breath, go for it. However, one of the differences between concentrating and Vipassana, concentration, you don't actually have to know much about the breathing. You're using the breath as a place to anchor the awareness. So the awareness can get still and relax and calm down because it's just kind of resting in one place. In Vipassana, you're trying to actually discern something about the characteristics of that breath. So the cognitive factor, the recognition factor, recognizing what's there becomes more important in Vipassana. In concentration, you don't have to know anything about the breath. You can leave a session of meditation doing concentration work, and you don't have to know anything about what the breath was like. You just had to have been there. You know, so it's kind of dumb in that way.
Kind of
concentration practice is kind of dumb. You know, it's just like, just stay there. You know, you don't have to know a lot more. See, with the function of what's happening in concentration is we're helping the mind become stiller and stiller, quieter and quieter, more peaceful. Mm-hmm. So we're focusing in concentration primarily on the point of concentration practice is to change your subjective state. The point of Vipassana practice is to understand something about what you're focusing on, understand the object, to see more clearly, penetrate what awareness can know. So I'm sitting here in this hot room, it's kind of warm, and I could kind of just relax into the heat, and it would change my subjective state to relax into the heat and just kind of let it take over and get more sleepy and tired and whatever, you know, it can make me very relaxed. Or I can be very curious about, this room feels kind of hot, what does it feel like, where do I feel it in my body? What does it feel like to have a contact of heat against my body? Where in my body do I feel it? Where does it seem to be coming from, the heat? And, you know, what's the texture of it? And so suddenly mind got kind of alert and investigative. What is this like? So the first one is kind of like leaning into the subjective state and really, you know, getting calmed by it, settled by it. So in concentration practice, you're focusing primarily on changing your subjective state through letting the mind be resting in one place. But Vipassana, you're trying to understand that place where the mind is focusing on, to see it more clearly, what actually is.
So I think you said during the course of these classes that insight doesn't really dawn in a concentrated state. It dawns when you do Vipassana. Or did I understand that right, or did I miss that?
So the question is, when does insight occur, and does it happen when you do concentration? Does it happen when you do Vipassana? I think it's best not to make a too hard and fast dichotomy between concentration practice and vipassana practice. In the classic books and in some people's discussion, they want to make a very sharp distinction between them. But there's a big overlap between the two. And so I think it's best not to make, you know... But generally, insight arises through vipassana practice, through being discerning what's actually your experience is. And so if you're only focusing on changing your subjective state of becoming calm, peaceful, stilling the mind, developing equanimity, developing the balance, the joy, the happiness that can come with concentration, then you know, you're not really learning something about the objects. You're just focusing on this calming down. And so you're not going to develop any wisdom by just, you know, stilling the formations, just by bringing the subjective change. You get some as you go along, for sure. One of the values of doing that kind of practice is the purification practice. And when as you're purifying stuff, you learn something about, you know, what gunks you up. And you also get the wisdom of knowing what a purified state is like. And that becomes a wonderful reference point to highlight what's going on the rest of your life. So it really helps. If you have a really pure state, then you can notice little irritants and, you know, and how they work much better than if you were always irritated.
So one thing that I bumped up against a lot over the course of these weeks is being very open, and then being just out of nowhere, this resistance comes to just call it resistance. That's what it is. I don't want to sit. I mean, it's not that I really don't, but it's like, and so that. I mean, I see it coming. I see how it comes. I see what it's like when it's there. I see what it. I know what it's going to be like if I follow it, or if I don't follow it. And that seems to me like, out of practicing concentration, I'm getting some understanding. It's not just that I'm
right.
Feeling.
No, it comes along. That's why I don't want to separate these absolutely. Mm-hmm. There is a lot of understanding come with concentration practice, but that's not the primary function of it. It's the function that what happens is more. What's happening more is a subjective change. That's the focus of deeper concentration practice, and focusing on the subjective then is kind of one of the things that guides you into a more concentrated state. So you're noticing how the concentration practice affects you subjectively, then becomes a biofeedback device to help you kind of go further into that state. So you notice the upwelling of the feelings of being concentrated, the feeling of being in your body, being embodied, suffused in your body with sensations, the joy, the happiness that can arise. And you notice it coming. First you might notice just a little bit, hints of it, and then you kind of egg it on, you kind of encourage it on by, oh, there it is, you know, it's kind of like you keep honing and developing the concentration on the breath or whatever it is, with that kind of initially in mind, kind of, to, you know, trying to develop it and strengthen it. You're kind of focusing and developing that subjective state. Or you turn your attention away from the breath entirely once you get some of the symptoms of getting concentrated, and you focus on those symptoms, and you're kind of trying to expand it, intensify it, evoke it. So the deepening concentration involves this, you know, attempt in a sense. The point of deepening concentration practice is to change your subjective state. The point of vipassana practice is not a subjective state, but rather has to do with being able to develop your capacity to see clearly what's there. And the byproduct of that, one of the byproducts or one of the functions of that, is to learn to have the capacity to be present for things as they are, without needing them to be different. To find that place where the mind is not for or against anything. And that's a very powerful place to discover. In concentration practice, you're not looking for that particularly, you're just looking how to get this subjective change, how to have a, you know, meditation experience.
So, just one last question. In regard to noticing a state that you want to egg on or that seems worthy of egging on, so to speak. So you're sitting there and then suddenly you just feel your heart open and you feel compassion or you feel whatever, love, whatever. How do you egg it on? What do you mean by egging it on? Do you mean... When you say that?
I don't know. I mean, it's a little bit hard for me with that kind of description to tell you exactly what to do. But from what you described, if I was trying to develop concentration, I would probably go back to the breathing and continue working on it. Because one of the dangers is if you do some concentration practice and there's a kind of opening into some level of being kind of compassionate or loving or open-hearted in some way, and then it's very easy then to get detracted by those states and kind of get, oh, this is great, or, you know, this, you know, start thinking about it or kind of indulging it a little bit. And so then you're no longer doing the meditation practice, but rather you're kind of a little bit...
feeling yourself being carried away.
Something. And then probably what will happen within a short period of time is your mind will start thinking.
Thinking
again. So certain states that arise, like what you described here, you might switch to do loving-kindness practice then to keep yourself anchored. But what you described, what I would do is I would just keep developing the concentration on the breath and just let those states, knowing those states that have arisen, are really conducive, really helpful for continuing to deepen the concentration.
Well, that's what I did because I didn't know how to egg it on, so I just followed the breath.
And what happened?
It was fine. I mean,
sometimes
the experience got more intense, and sometimes it was just that my attention went back to just the breath, to be with the breath.
Yeah.
So, I guess where I was going was that I had experiences where I felt my heart open and more dramatic way than normal.
Yeah.
And a part of me wanted to really go with it.
Yeah.
And a part of me didn't know exactly how to go with it without just losing track of everything I was doing. Because it was so overwhelming in a way.
Yeah, sometimes you just want to surrender to some of these things. If it's not normal for you to feel a lot of love and compassion, and that's what's going on, then maybe you surrender to it and just kind of, you know, stay with it, and maybe stay with the breath, but kind of breathe into those feelings of compassion or love, and just kind of enjoy it. Let it kind of bathe you. Let it kind of recondition you, program you. Kind of let it be a rest for the mind and the heart, and then see what happens. And if you find after a while you get kind of discursive and thinking a lot, then you might want to go back to the breath in a more concentrated way. So wide range of things you could do. It's a little bit hard to give you simple advice here.
Sure. It's interesting to discover, though, that it's a process of sort of playing around with yourself and see what happens within the context of the instructions.
Yeah.
But
I don't think I think it's probably it's almost impossible to be a meditation teacher. You know, I think I do a terrible job. And I don't even can't even approximate how to actually explain to you how you're supposed to do the practice, and you poor students you listen to me and you try to put it into practice these bumbling words of mine, but really it's really a trial and error where each of you has to find your own way. So you take the instructions you get from the various teachers, and then see how try your understanding of it to apply it. And see what the consequences are, and learn from your own experience, and find your own way. And really, learning from your own experience is so important, because then you have something you can take with you, all kinds of different situations, and you're not always relying on the meditation teacher or the books, and some people are a little bit unsettled by that because they want to have the security of knowing there's one way, and they can hold on to that. But I think that it's valuable to feel that you're learning to. Rather than having one way, you're actually learning the skills, learning the ability to find your own way. Yes, Ed.
This past week, I had a cold, and you know, just sometimes you have a cold, brain just kind of doesn't function. And usually, when that happens, I'm doing Vipassana. I tried that with concentration.
So usually, when you do
Vipassana, I usually just give up. Oh. Oh.
Yeah, you're required to in this class to be a good
That's
Buddhist.
Right.
Yeah.
Hey, it was like you get to like two, and then the mind just kind of floats off somewhere. It wasn't enough, I don't know, there's not enough mental juice functioning to be able to pull it back. And you have any suggestions?
Well, first, which I say often, is that the continuity of your best effort is really what's really, is really important. And so that when you're sick or something's happening where you don't have the same kind of pristine effort you would have at other times, it's well worth giving it your best effort that you have available to you, because the continuity, see, concentration comes with continuity of practice. And the continuity of your best effort bears fruit. So even though you can only get to two, you keep trying and keep applying, keep doing your best. That doing your best then bears fruit, you know, over time, and will build a kind of strength internally. That makes it possible for you to develop, the concentration.
It feels like it's practicing bad habits, though. You know, if I wake up after 10 minutes and realize my mind's wandered off, aren't I reinforcing when I sit down that my mind's going to wander off?
Maybe. So you want to give it your best effort, and I think just try it your best. However, you have to also want to try to be a little wise and discerning of what's happening. So your best effort together with your best judgment. So your best judgment here might be that maybe you need to change a little bit how you do the practice when you're sick. I actually find sometimes when I get sick, it's very hard to meditate. My mind just drifts, and I get out of the sitting, and that was a wasted sitting. You know, it occurs to me, but then I remind myself, nothing's ever wasted when you practice. And sometimes when I get sick, it actually helps me get concentrated. There's a way in which I'm much more in my body, and I'm kind of like contained much more, and I feel intimate and connected. And when I do, when I'm sick, I much more often do concentration practice in the Vipassana, because what I'm trying to do when I'm sick is to relax my body. I feel like the more relaxed I can get, the more healing it is for me. So I often do that with the breathing, and I'll focus on the breathing, and then each time I breathe out, I'll focus on relaxing some part of my body. And often there's very subtle or some tensions I can find in my body when I'm sick. And I want to try to have the least amount of tension anywhere. So I just kind of do a kind of relaxation exercise that's a little bit more of a concentration than it is mindfulness. I'm not trying. Well, I do a kind of a body scan. I do it. So it's kind of free flowing wherever my attention goes. And I'm not just simply trying to know the place of the tension. I'm actually actively relaxing it when I'm sick, just relax there, the tension, and so with the breathing also, it can be, you know, just use the breath as a way of helping you to relax. And if you're using it as a relaxation aid, it might be more compelling to stay with it. And sometimes a few times when I've been really sick, I felt like the practice was my lifeline. I felt it was really helpful to kind of stay there, because otherwise my mind would get filled with self-pity. Poor Gil, you know, he's so sick. And then I know those kind of thoughts are not healing. So I'd rather not have those. And so I hold on to the practice and let go of those and try to stay with something much more wholesome. Well, how do you define contemplation?
It just seems to be calm reflection on what's going on.
Uh-huh.
If I'm not, if I'm real honest with myself. I mean, that's what I've done in the past. I'm just wondering how you define it, and it has any place in practice. Uh-huh. Does it always just go discursive, or it's always been?
A contemplative practice, calm thinking about things, reflecting on things, is a beautiful thing that human beings can do. It's very valuable. It's very enriching to do that. And many spiritual traditions, including Buddhism, emphasize the value of doing those kind doing that kind of work. And there's many ways of doing it. That can be part of the benefits from doing something like concentration practice is it quiets and calms the mind down enough so that when you turn your mind towards being reflective, that then it's much more workable. You're more focused. You can think clearer. You can think more in a more useful way. You get a lot of good thinking in. And sometimes it's done, you know, like you said, just thinking about just what's going on right then. It can also be thinking about certain themes. For example, thinking about some of the Buddha's teachings. Really thinking about that and massaging and working them out in your own mind. Contemplate that. It can be very valuable to do that. However, that is not mindfulness practice. And so a lot of people here in the West have already very strong tendencies towards reflection and thinking about things. And if they sit down to meditate and they're just doing more of the same, they're kind of reinforcing that part of they're always thinking about things. And it's really helpful to kind of realize that you have another capacity, and that is to have this non-discursive awareness. And that it might be more useful for you to have some times where you go underneath the radar of your thoughts and go into the kind of the stiller, silent part of the mind and explore your life and what's actually going on with the silence of the mind rather than the thinking of the mind. And so both with concentration and with vipassana, especially in the circles that we're in, an encouragement not to think about things when you're practicing, but rather to stay with the bare attention to what's happening. Sometimes vipassana practice is taught as a contemplative practice, where you actually pick up certain, you develop very strong concentration, and then you back off from the concentration and use that very soft mind to actually think about Buddhist themes. And that's one way vipassana is done. In the traditions that I was trained in, it was not done that way. Vipassana was done with a non-discursive mind. So I mean, it's very enriching to do contemplative practice, like you're talking about. For someone who wants to do vipassana practice, however, I would encourage them to find a different time to do that than when they're doing vipassana.
I noticed you're saying things about switching from one thing to another. In the past, it seems like maybe it's because we didn't have concentration as a tool or talk about something. It would be like, don't start with metta and then change to vipassana. In a specific city.
Yeah, that we said?
I thought that's something I heard.
Could be. I mean, it's very common for us teachers to say, one of the dangers is that if people have too many practices up their sleeves, that they're just bouncing around, you know, they do 2-3 minutes of metta, but this is not really working so well, I think I'll do body sweep, and this is not, I don't like this, you know, and maybe the breath I've heard is a good practice, I'll stay with the breath, and after 30 seconds, well, I don't get it very far on the breath. And then I've heard that listening to sounds is really good. Now listen to sounds for a while, and oh, that really works really well for me. And then, you know, it's not really that profound, sounds. And maybe I should think about infinite space and just kind of dissolve in it. Let's try that. I'm just getting a headache trying to do that. Well, that doesn't work. So headache. I've heard that doing mindfulness on headaches is a really good thing. So where are those sensations? And then you do that for a little bit. Oh, I'm so tired of this. There's so much work in meditation. I'm always trying. You know, so that's one of the syndromes. People are always changing and switching. And at some point, you want to have some commitment to one practice. But, it's okay to do some changing, you know, if you find it strategic. If you're doing a vipassana practice, it's very powerful to have a real commitment to that. It's unvarying, unchanging. Not be involved in strategies. And just, okay, this period for this retreat, I'm just going to do vipassana practice. Come what may. That's a very powerful way of practicing. But it's also okay, it's very powerful to actually be more, you know, to vary it a little bit. And as I said earlier, it's one of the classic ways of doing vipassana practice is to start with a little bit of metta. Or start with a couple of different things, you know, or start with concentration for a little while. And I know some teachers who have, not in our scene, but some Buddhist teachers who say, who divide up like a 50-minute, 45-minute meditation session, 50-minute, and have 10-minute segments. The first 10 minutes you do kind of settling in, the second 10 minutes you do metta, the third 10 minutes you do choiceless awareness of mindfulness, and the last 10 minutes you do something else. And sometimes the retreat leader will say, okay, 10 minutes are up, switch. And, you know, it's one way of kind of staying connected and engaged, and they find it helpful. So there's many ways of doing this. So you know, one of the shortcomings that I have as a teacher is that I see there's a place for all of it. And so it's really, you know, it's a matter of kind of, rather than making it really simple for people, and like especially now, and say, you just do this one thing, you have to have some wisdom and understand some of the principles and find out by trial and error what really works for you. And then find, you know, what you find your way. And then you can do that together with a teacher, and you can kind of, they can help, the teachers can help you be a little more discerning about what's useful and not useful. But if you find it useful to start with, 10 minutes of contemplative practice, like you mentioned, that helps you kind of settles you and quiets you down, and then switching over to non-discursive practice, that's a quite valid thing to do. Right.
And I thought of it that way before, but now having done the concentration practice where I was counting the breaths, it seems like it's a very different mental state. Concentration and counting the breaths is what I'm doing better for myself, but as soon as I try to do better for another person, I'm not sequestering. There's another
right.
That the attention is getting focused on. It seems more mindful.
I'm not sure what to say. I suppose that when you think focusing on a different person, you can be much more a lot of associations and thoughts and reactions, a lot of that stuff can come up on that person. The idea when you're doing metta as a concentration practice is that you're developing actually stilling the mind or being absorbed in not necessarily just one thing. Sometimes just one thing, saying the phrases. Sometimes with metta practice, you hold an image of the person in front of you. You say the phrases, and you stay connected to your body. So those three things together, kind of, you're quite absorbed doing those three things. But you're not doing vipassana on it. You're just letting the mind become stiller and stiller as you do that. Now, there is subjectively a different result from doing metta than there is doing concentration on the breath. In a sense that sometimes with metta, kind of loving, friendly feelings might arise. Whereas you do concentration on the breath, those feelings, friendly feelings might not arise. You might get joy that might arise because you're getting concentrated, but it doesn't have the same flavor as being this kind of soft, loving kind of feeling. And so there's different results from the two. I don't know if that was clear enough, what I just said. But
can you say a little bit more about what access concentration is, how one might recognize it, or egg it on?
So the question is, how do you recognize access concentration? The primary definition, the primary way of recognizing access concentration is that you're no longer caught up by the hindrances. So the mind is now able to be concentrated in the present moment. You turn your attention to the breath or to metta or whatever it might be, and you can pretty well stay on there. And you know that the hindrances are not going to pull you away. The hindrances are no longer an issue. You might have bubbling up some sensual desire or some ill will, but it doesn't grab you, just like washes off you. Just like you don't pick it up, you don't get involved, you can let go of it really easily. the mind can stay present and stay focused. So this, the settling of the hindrances is the definition, the primary definition of excess concentration. Then there might be different symptoms that people might feel with excess concentration. The person might feel the breath gets very subtle. The person might feel very connected to their body. Some of the jhanic factors that we talked about last week might arise in the person, and so they can recognize those things. But the primary thing is the hindrances. So the hindrances are the big hurdle for concentration and mindfulness practice. Is to in order to get into concentration work, or seriously into vipassana, you have to find some way to let the hindrances put the hindrances to rest, so they no longer influence the mind. That's really the really a key thing. So learning how to practice with the hindrances and learning how to have a mind become stronger than them is a big part of what we're working on in initial periods of practice. And then once you're able to have a mind that's strong enough to overcome the hindrances, that's when the mind really becomes workable. Can be worked to do something. Until that point, you can't really work the mind so well, because you start doing something with your attention, and it slips off into a hindrance.
So I know you can reflect on it and notice that you're either bothered by the hindrances or not bothered by the hindrances, but how do you know you're not bothered by the hindrances when you're just practicing?
If you can apply your attention to where you want to put it, mm-hmm. and you can keep it there relatively well, and you know the mind's not being pulled or being trapped or being ambushed or being, the mind feels stronger or feels like it's risen above any tendency to be interested in the hindrances, so the mind becomes workable. You can apply your mind, and you're free of the hindrances. They're not going to pull you.
So, is that what excess concentration is? You just come to that place, and then just when you're there, you're there. Or do you nudge it along a little bit once you recognize that you're there?
Well, once you're in excess concentration, then you want to continue developing the concentration. Sometimes excess concentration is like I don't know if it's a good analogy, but it's like you've reached a threshold. Like if you come, like there's this big house you can go explore, and you finally made your way to the doorstep. And it was a long, muddy path to get there, and it was really hard to get there because you kept being, it was so muddy. Your feet kept stepping into the mud, and it's hard work pulling yourself out. And every once in a while, you'd fall in the mud, and you'd fall asleep in the mud, and you wake up and say, "Boy, how could I fall asleep in the mud for so long?" And you get up and you dry yourself off, and you take another step, and there's another mud puddle there, and it's really hard going. But you keep plugging away, doing your best to practice. At some point, you make it to the doorstep, and there's no more mud on the doorstep. So you get on the doorstep, and you're on the doorstep, and you're really happy because that the mud is no longer going to bother you, at least for now. But then once you're on the doorstep, you want to go through the door. So you want, if you're doing concentration practice, you want to develop the concentration further.
So, access concentration and the concentration one experiences in the lower jhanic states are actually different, or is it the same
thing? Well, it's a matter of degree. So with there's different degrees of strength in concentration. Mm-hmm. So strength of being able to hold the mind one pointedly. So as the mind gets mind goes from access concentration to full concentration, the definition of the change is that the mind now has strong sense of one-pointedness. With excess concentration, there's one-pointedness there. I think with full concentration, it's much more developed, the full one concentration. But the definition of the changing from access to the first jhana involves this intensification of those five factors, the five jhanic factors. So when you can recognize the presence of those five jhanic factors, then you've entered into the first jhana. together with some of the kind of subjective feelings that go with that.
And would you tell us again the five factors?
The initial application of mind, the sustained application of mind, joy, happiness, and one-pointedness. And the one, you know, so, yeah. So there are many different other things that go on, other mental states, other subjective states that occur in the jhanas besides those five. But those are the five that define the five jhanas. And the others might or might not arise. For example, if you're doing loving kindness practice, you might feel actually a lot of metta together with the presence of those five jhanic factors in the first jhana. But if you're doing a concentration on the breath, you might not feel the feelings of metta. So there's other factors that can be present. And that somewhere, I probably have it wrong now, but there's some Abhidharma list of 32 different mental factors that are present in when you're in the jhanas. But there's the five jhanic factors which are the key ones that really define what the jhanas are. And they're the ones that stand out the strongest, I think, for the most part. Yeah.
Can you please comment for a moment on the relationship between this excess concentration when hindrances are no longer hindrance and external distractions? I found this weekend I was meditating in a different place physically, and I know it's really much more susceptible to the external ones pulling me away. I'm just sort of curious how that maybe ties into the hindrances themselves or maybe a whole different issue.
Yeah, I don't know how to answer that. You know, I don't know so well. I know for me when I'm in something that I recognize as access concentration, I don't think of access concentration as being, you know, very clearly defined boundaries, like a range kind of what can be access concentration, in my mind at least. And but I could be in a state that I would characterize as access concentration. The hindrances are no longer operating, and it's relatively easy for me to stay focused on my breath, for example, and I can really apply it there. And I might be aware of sounds around me, and I have some ability to choose to actually ignore them and stay on the breath. It's like the center of gravity for attention becomes the breath. It's like that's where downhill is. It's like that's where you'd rather be. That's where unless something might pull me away into sounds, but it's really where I want to be is with the breath. So I come back to it, or I kind of settle back on it, or there's sometimes a feeling like a rubber band that pulls me back to it. There's a kind of a feeling of, for me, this is all very personal, some of these descriptions, so you have to find out for yourself. But when I get into access concentration, I kind of like I've locked into a groove. Like I'm in a groove now, and so like I'm on that groove. And there might be things that I become aware of around me. But I'm kind of settled in that groove, or it's like a canal, and the ball is rolling down the canal, and something pulls the ball up the sides a little bit, but the ball wants to come back into the center of the canal and keep rolling down. So I'm kind of feeling kind of being, and when it's really strong, the concentration, then there's actually feeling a very strong feeling of being locked in. It's like sometimes the body gets the spine sometimes will become very upright and get a feeling also of being locked in. Just kind of, when the concentration is very powerful, everything kind of a locking in, but the mind is still also very soft and pliable. It's very soft, but so it kind of in the groove or something like that.
My experience I had this weekend was an epiphany. I hadn't really realized this consciously, but I was having a good meditation. I felt to judge it was. Like I was settling in and was staying with the breath well. And someone entered the room, and I was completely thrown off guard and lost. And had a really difficult time continuing even after they left. That's when meditation. And that really left me sort of wondering how my attempts to address my internal hindrances versus and how that plays external things, how external goes. It just sort of really threw me off.
The description in the excess concentration, the classic description is that the hindrances are suppressed. They haven't been resolved. So they're you know, and if you have a particularly you know powerful passion for some of the hindrances, you know, you might have managed to suppress them, but that power is kind of just lurking there, waiting to come back into play. So given the right conditions, you know, they'll come right back up. And sometimes with concentration, the mind has become still, the mind has become concentrated, the mind has become kind of open and not a lot of tendency to a lot of distractions. And sometimes if one big distraction arises, the mind will kind of lock on that much more strongly than it would if you're in a normal kind of everyday street consciousness where you're kind of scattered. It's like, you know, you can be walking down the street and you might have lust. But there's a lot of other things going on there, and you know, you kind of, you know, your mind goes off, and you know, it's not like, you know, like locked onto it. But one of the dangers of being concentrated is that concentration, they can lock on to certain thought patterns or ideas or feelings, and they can actually be much more powerful than usual. It's like, so, you know, suddenly you have lust, but there's not many other distractions. something Robert said earlier. Maybe wanted to mention that it's quite common that when people experience some kind of what they might describe as an opening experience, as Robert used, we felt very opened, right? Some kind of transformative experience, some kind of something more dramatic, where the mind, you feel much more opened or more at peace or resolved, or some kind of realization experience that people have. It's quite common, they're not universal, quite common that afterwards people have much more difficulty. And part of the reason for that, I mean, I don't know exactly why the reason for that is, but this is my guess, you know, this is my understanding, my best kind of understanding of this, is that it's as if the psyche has generally been open in a sense, but because now it's open, it has room to deal with some of the stuff that hasn't been dealt with before. So suddenly these things bubble up into that space. And sometimes people get depressed after, you know, or have been greatly challenged after, you know, well, how could this happen? You know, I had never felt so much bliss and joy and opening and whatever in my life a week ago or a day ago. And now I just feel wretched, you know. But rather than being discouraged, it's a good sign. It means that you've opened up the space to allow that stuff to come up so you can work on it. So, you know, for you, it might be that actually, you know, it was very valuable for you to have the concentration you had. When the person came into the room, some tendency that's very powerful in you came to the forefront. And now you got a chance to really look at it in a way maybe you normally can't. So probably what I would do then in that kind of situation is I would switch quickly to Vipassana. Say, great! Now I have this concentration and ability and I get to study this, you know, my lust really well. You know, you have optimum conditions for studying lust. Great. And then learn, and then see if you can develop a different relationship to it than you normally do, and I don't know how you normally are with it. It was lust, wasn't it? Is that what you said? Did I just make that up? What?
It was a family member.
Oh. Well, sometimes, you know, it helps if I concentrate better.
In my concentration practice, that in the morning it's very easy to become concentrated, and in the evening, when sort of my mind's mentally fatigued and my body's mentally fatigued, I'm physically fatigued, and I probably need the concentration more because, you know, it's more stress at that time, then it's harder to become concentrated. Do you have any suggestions on types of ways of entering concentration when you're sort of mentally and physically?
So how to get concentrated when you're mentally and physically tired? One way is to get refreshed. And there's a number of ways of doing that. I mean, you don't have to think of your meditation as being the way to solve all your, you know, every, you know, the meditation has to be the way you find balance. I mean, it might be more useful to go and take a shower and look out the window for 20 minutes, you know, or do something kind of very relaxing, and then meditate. So once you're kind of refreshed that way. Sometimes when I meditate in the late afternoon, the busyness, the activity of the day is still there, and the tiredness of the day is there. I'll try my best to stay concentrated, but I don't do a very good job for the first 20 minutes. And what's happening is I'm kind of reintegrating, partly, and kind of getting some rest, you know, that nod off. And then after about 20 minutes, it seems to be this, you know, suddenly I wake up, and suddenly my mind is really clear. And then it's really easy to stay concentrated. Like, I've kind of, everything's had a chance to integrate and settle and be processed or whatever it does during those first 20 minutes. So I just have to give myself that time to let that happen in the afternoon. And then the second 20 minutes is much better. So you might do something, you know, non-meditative to get yourself refreshed and rested and integrated. Or you might, you know, think of the first period of meditation as a time to really get rest. But, you know, by maybe focusing more on relaxation practice. Or just doing the concentration practice the best you can and just let it be as it is. Do you find it, how long do you sit for in the evening?
45 minutes.
And is it, you tired the whole time?
No.
Is there a shift at some point?
After 10 or 15 minutes, I'm okay. Yeah, I'm so. I can be concentrated.
Oh, so that's better than me.
<I'm older than>
So you know, it's, maybe that's, I mean, that's the way it is. You have 10 minutes. I mean, that's not, you know, to get kind of yourself regrouped. That sounds great. And you can also do, you know, when you're tired, you can also do walking meditation. You know, if you have trouble staying focused and because you're tired or don't have much energy. Sometimes doing walking meditation can bring energy and keep you engaged. And walking meditation is a great way of doing both concentration and mindfulness practice. So any other things people would like to ask before we start with the meditation? Yes? Down below means what?
Pardon?
Down below means what?
What
does down below mean?
Oh, sort of sinking feeling. It's not asleep, and I'm still counting.
Yeah.
It's sort of that hypnagogic kind of, the mind is going a bit, and I'm sort of watching it think that I'm not very alert.
So, two things I think of saying. One is that concentration is an impermanent phenomenon like everything else. So, concentration has like a lifetime. And sometimes lifetime is 5 minutes. You know, you can do it and then it kind of fades. Sometimes it's, you know, longer. And for most people, you know, if you sit long enough, concentration will start fading because it's an impermanent phenomenon. It's there because of different conditions coming together and at some point it'll fade. And so you want to be kind of equanimous about the fact that, you know, it's an impermanent phenomenon. It rises and passes like everything else. You can get concentrated, and then you can stay concentrated for a while, and then it wanes after a while. Not necessarily. I mean, it might be that 40 minutes is, you know, if that's your regular sitting, period. It might have those, you know, that kind of pattern, but then you're building over the days and the weeks, and it's probably over time you probably find that you can sustain it longer and longer as you develop that muscle, and also you develop the intensity of it. You settle more, you get to concentrate more quickly, and the concentration will be more powerful, and you might still be that, you know, 40 minutes of good sitting and the 5 minutes of, you know, get tired at the end. I don't know how it'll be for you. But over time, the continuity will develop that muscle. And so you might not have the cascading joy today, but you might have it, you know, in a few months as you build up the continuity. And you might not have it on a regular basis. It might be, you know, when all the conditions come together just to be right. I mean, if you're sitting, I mean, it's very interesting to watch how our meditations change from day to day. And some people report that they notice a change through the week, that Monday is the really sharpest day for meditation, and then each, you know, Monday as the week goes along, they get a little duller as the week goes along because they're a little bit tired. You know, people are refreshed in the weekend and then they get tired as they go through the work week, and so they see that pattern. You know, they just know that's the pattern, and over the months and years, it seems to overall improve, but the pattern remains. So the Friday is the most distracted sitting. It was the most distracted sitting for the last 10 years, but it's a lot better than it was 10 years ago. Just that whole thing has improved, but there's that pattern. Or, you know, as you're getting, if you get close to like April 15th and your taxes are due, you know, you might find, you know, that it's a little bit harder to get concentrated. Or if you have to go to, you know, you have to go to court because of a speeding ticket or something, you know. So all kinds of causes and conditions that can make you, you know, waver a little bit. And so you have to kind of be able to surf and be graceful about, you know, over, as the conditions of your life change and things happen, your ability to get concentrated will change too. And so what's important is just to keep giving it the best effort you have. The continuity of your best effort is what's important. And then at some point, you know, the conditions come together well enough and you can drop much further.
So not necessarily to stand up or open my eyes? Or
for the last 5 minutes?
Or
well, I think what you... I think if it's only 5 minutes at the end, I think it's what's useful to do then is to keep trying to develop the concentration during those last 5 minutes, but try to work with that state. See reinvigorate yourself. Say, okay, this has happened. This is my pattern. This is what I get really calm and kind of just groggy or something at the very end. Let me see what I can do to see if I can change that and try to reinvigorate the concentration or investigate this or, you know, sit up straighter or arouse. Can I figure out somehow to arouse a kind of mental effort? And you might take months before you figure out how to do that. But rather than thinking of it as a problem, think of it as an opportunity to see if you can, you know, learn some other way of developing concentration, develop other muscles, other activities. And you might, with time, find how to work with that state in a way that's much more useful. And you might actually be able to override it at some point or change it when it arises. Those are my thoughts. Sometimes I sit for a particular length of time, but if I have a kind of open time, I'll just sit down to sit for however long, and I'll sit sometimes for an hour and a half or something like that, and I finally stop sitting when I feel the concentration is waning. You know, as long as I feel like I'm engaged and it's going well and I'm kind of absorbing what's going on, great. And then at some point there's kind of after all these years of meditation, I'm often tricked by my mind at that point because I think I'm much more concentrated than I am. As it begins to wane, I feel calm, it's kind of a nice feeling, I feel kind of this lingering feeling of calm and peace and ease, and my mind is beginning to think more and more. And I'm not often so quick to catch the thinking because I've kind of been seduced by the feelings of concentration that have arisen. And so, you know, I think I'm actually doing fine, and I'm kind of keep applying myself, and then after a while, you know, I realize, oh, wait a minute, I know this state. And then, you know, it's time to stop.
Help you get into a concentrated state, so you're sitting for 20 minutes
Well, for me, it's been, for me personally, it makes a big difference. Oh yeah. Generally, there, you know, the longer I sit, you know, up to point, you know, the more concentrated I get. I can really, you know, get into it and kind of work in that state. So, so you know.
So that could be a problem. Like if you're sitting 20 minutes, that's just maybe not enough time.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay. So you know, some of you have been sitting now for a while. If you'd like to stand for a minute, you've more than. So get yourself kind of into your meditation posture and in some way or other, turn your attention inward. Some way or other, tune into the subjective state of how you are from the inside out. Some way or other, see if you can enter into your body. Submerge yourself in your body, feeling what's happening in your body from the inside out. And as you breathe, see if you can soften your body, your mind, your heart. In whatever way you can, let there be a softening of who you are. Softening of your resistance. Some people brace themselves against life. Softening. It doesn't have to be completely, but just soften the shoulders, the stomach. Soften your chest and the inside of your chest, your heart. Let the warmth of the room help soften and then let your mind soften. The thinking mind that's maybe so tired, fatigued from all its concerns. Give it a rest, softening your mind. I sometimes find it helpful, the image of letting the mind flatten out, kind of settle and relax outwards in all directions, like a still forest pool, alpine lake. Or the softening of the mind lets the mind become spacious, being aware of the boundaryless nature of mind. The mind has no fixed limit, boundary, edges. What we call the mind is diffuse with the environment around it. And we often talk about bringing the attention to the breath. Instead of doing that, let the breathing come to your awareness. Keep the awareness, the mind, soft and relaxed, and allow the sensations of breathing to enter into awareness, into your mind. And then instead of holding the attention on the breath, gently but firmly, hold the breathing within the awareness. Let your breathing be on the mind. Letting the breathing come to awareness. And the rhythmic quality of breathing, in a sense, massages the awareness, or is like the waves on the shore that roll up and down across the shore. So the breathing, the waves of the breathing, sensations in your body, they roll across the awareness, back and forth. If your mind is active, or you have some agitation in your body, then let the breathing be a calming influence. As the breath comes into awareness, let the breathing soothe or calm your body and your mind. Especially as you breathe out, let the breathing out maybe have a settling effect on your system. If you need to relax, focus a little bit more fully on the exhalation. If you're sleepy and the mind's already kind of dull, you don't want to relax anymore, then you want to bring energy into the system. And then maybe you can focus a little bit more on the inhalation and let the energizing, let the breath be energizing. Uplifting. Rather than letting go with exhalation, be energized with the inhalation. Energized and stilled at the same time. Let go of any thoughts and concerns you might have. And settle into your breathing. Settle down into it. Settle down as if you're going to be rooted in your breathing. let yourself become as totally involved as possible with this one little corner of the universe that we call the breathing. There's a whole universe to be discovered within your breathing. Let the mind become still and quiet as you enter the breath to become the breathing. Try to become your breathing. If you feel any joy or pleasure connected to breathing in any way at all, somehow associated with focusing on the breath, if it helps you get more absorbed in the breathing, intensify that pleasure or enjoy it, or let that be the aid. Be more fully present with the breath. Become the pleasure, become the joy. And now, as you're staying with your breathing, become interested in getting to know the breath a little bit better. Understand a little bit what's actually happening as you're breathing. What happens to the sensations? What kind of sensations make up the experience of breathing? And then notice that as you're taking an interest in the breathing, as you know that you're breathing, there's two things happening. There's the sensations of breathing, whatever they might be, and there's a knowing of those sensations. Sensations of movement, of pressure or tingling or warmth or coolness, vibration, pressure. There are the particular physical manifestations, sensations of breathing. And there's the mind's ability to know those sensations, to recognize it. It's very simple. There's sensation and the knowing of that sensation. The knowing of a sensation arises and passes together with a sensation. The deepening of vipassana practice entails developing, strengthening, moment by moment, this faculty of the mind to know what's happening. There's what the experience of breathing, and the knowing of it. The mind can get very quiet, very concentrated, very absorbed in the breath, for example. But there you see the difference between the breathing sensations and the knowing of it. If you want to deepen concentration, he would forget about this distinction between the sensations and the knowing of them. And you would enter the breath. You'd become the breathing. You would simply, as best you can, let the awareness and the breathing become the same thing. No distinctions between knowing and the breathing. Just breathing. Letting the experience of breathing absorb you. So you get absorbed in your breathing. Absorbed by your breathing. And then in the last couple of minutes of this sitting, spend this time just reviewing a little bit what happened during this meditation. Could you turn on the light? This switches. think it's the two left-hand switches. And then you can take the big steering wheel and that's below you and turn us a little bit towards the north. That's good. So, what was that like for some of you? Could you follow along? And what happened during that sitting? You have to kind of rouse yourself a little bit here so you can talk. I said, let the breath come to you. You didn't get that? It's okay not to get it. How many of you didn't get that? You all, oh, some of you didn't get it. Good. So, you know, we sometimes have a kind of a fixed idea of what the mind is, and we think the mind is something we're going to, we use the language, you know, turn my mind towards something, or maybe some people jerk their mind on their breath, you know, the mind goes away and they jerk it back on the breath, or they bring their mind to the breathing, they bring their attention to the breath, as if the mind is the kind of thing you can kind of haul around, you know, at will. And it's just kind of an image we have of the mind, which sometimes is not very helpful. Sometimes it works. It's just as valid to say, let the breathing come to your awareness, come to your mind. Or if you're sitting here, and like this is what Sylvia Boorstein likes to teach, is when you notice your mind has been distracted, you're not on your breathing anymore, at that moment, notice if you're breathing in or breathing out. And what happens then is it's more of a sense of just kind of noticing what's happening, as opposed to trying to bring your mind to the breath and then noticing what the breath is like. So it's much more peaceful, more gentle. Just notice what's happening. Let the breath come to you. Let the breath absorb you. So I know it's so this kind of language is not like some true way of seeing things, but also saying I'm going to bring my mind to the breath is not a true way of seeing things either. It's kind of a conventional way we talk, so if it didn't make any sense to you, it's okay. If the other sense makes sense, then fine. Well, it's very disappointing for me to kind of assume that nothing happened to any of you that's worth talking about, and it's just like, you know... Uh-huh. I can't tell the difference between falling asleep and being concentrated. Chances are that then you're either asleep or getting kind of drowsy. There should be a kind of a vitality, aliveness, a clarity. But can you describe a little bit what your experience was, maybe in retrospect?
Just that the time went by very quickly.
Oh, that maybe is not sleepiness. When a person is really absorbed, time can go really fast. Was there a sense of clarity during that time?
No, more just a sense of absorption.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure. Usually when I sleep and start to dream, then you can kind of tell because your thoughts are getting very peculiar.
Right. Did you have many thoughts, or thoughts were kind of no thoughts?
I just seem to be vaguely aware of the water sometimes.
Okay. Yeah, so maybe you were quite nicely absorbed. It could well be. Yes?
I like the image of the mind expanding to be a still mountain lake or whatever. In comparison, I think I'm usually climbing the mind down on something that's useful.
Nice. Yes?
For me, I found it a much gentler concentration that way. I think I've been sort of getting toward.
That's fine. If you don't need it, then you don't need to. If you don't feel like the breath is, the counting is helpful, you don't have to do it. Or it might be that you find a way to count that's much more subtle. Try to find a very, very subtle whisper, a little corner of the mind that kind of just almost doesn't, you know, not even sub-vocalizing, but somehow is, you know, keeping count.
I had this sensation of my mind as being kind of a flat, infinite platter, right? And then it stopped being a platter, right? And was kind of pulsing, so that it was. I tried very hard not to make an image out of it, but there was this kind of feeling, and I got so relaxed that I started getting really drowsy. So
right.
Then I went back to counting my breath and sort of let go of that feeling. But I found that really interesting because it was infinite.
Uh-huh.
It didn't seem to be this mass of stuff inside my skull that is not mind.
That's one of the qualities of consciousness. It has a kind of feeling, there's a kind of infinite quality to its boundaries. And when a person goes into the higher jhanas, I didn't talk about last week, but the four higher ones, one of the things that a person gets absorbed in is infinite space or infinite consciousness, or consciousness itself that has no boundaries, or just space that has no boundaries. So there's different aspects of awareness, of experience, which get singled out and get absorbed in it, and everything else falls away. Usually people are not that attentive to it, are they?
It was like maybe a whole season in a garden growing.
Uh-huh.
You could watch it from the very, very beginning all uh-huh. the way to the end of it.
Great. So at the very end I talked about the difference between concentration practice and mindfulness practice around the breath. Does that make sense, that distinction? Could you follow along the distinction between, first of all, the distinction between the sensations of breathing and the knowing of those sensations? Does that make sense to some of you? And then the kind of healing that difference, or letting go of that difference, and just kind of becoming the breath, or just being absorbed in the breath, or just focus, not letting there be that difference, just let the awareness kind of become the breath. See that difference too? That distinction is one of the things that points to the difference between vipassana and concentration. And as the vipassana practice gets quite deep, at some point, so you need a lot of concentration to do vipassana practice. As I keep saying, this is why I want to teach this class, so people can up their concentration to do vipassana. A very important part of the Theravadin tradition teaches that in order to do vipassana practice, the person has to be at least in access concentration. That if you're doing mindfulness practice, and then mindfulness becomes vipassana. When the mindfulness has brought you to the point of being access concentration, when the hindrances are no longer an issue and you can really focus on what's there in a very penetrating way, And then access concentration is a kind of a fork in the road. You can either go the concentration route, get more and more absorbed in your in the meditation practice, or you can go into the Vipassana route. And the doorway to Vipassana world is seeing the distinction between the experience and the knowing of the experience. It isn't so much that you need to now go look for that. I think that might actually kind of be a problem. But at some point, when you're quite concentrated, that'll be, and you're doing Vipassana, that'll become quite clear that there's two different things going on at each moment. There's the experience and the knowing of that experience. And the deepening of Vipassana follows from that initial clear seeing, clear awareness of that distinction between those two. Yes.
So you are like watching this all happen. Is that what you mean when you're doing this Vipassana? You know, all these things are, you know, these experiences, but you're sort of watching them.
Yeah, kind
of.
Yeah, kind of. I'd be very careful with the words here. But generally what you said is right. But I would say not that you are watching it. I would say that there's the awareness of the difference between the experience and the knowing of that experience. They're seen as two different phenomena. And whereas when you're doing concentration practice, that distinction kind of falls away. Sometimes when you're very concentrated, people talk about no longer seeing any difference between themselves and the object, or the subject-object distinction falls away, or you become the object completely, is one way some people talk about. And whereas in Vipassana, you're not getting absorbed at that level. You're developing this, the knowing, the recognition factor of the mind that actually knows that this is going on, and knows that the knowing is different from the experience being known. That becomes really important for Vipassana, because Vipassana involves a recognition of what's happening. And there's a kind of you kind of know that you know what's happening, in a sense. Does that make sense? Does that make sense to all of you?
It's, I mean, don't you always there always is that awareness, right? That's there.
Yeah, there's always awareness, and yeah. It's a little bit complicated, or it's a little bit arbitrary how we want to understand what's happening when we're aware of something. I mean, it's like awareness of anything is actually kind of a... The whole thing of awareness is kind of a... I mean, there are technical descriptions of what happens, but I'm a little bit mistrustful of technical descriptions. I think light. Is it a particle or is it a wave? You know, it kind of depends on, I guess, I don't know much about physics, but it kind of depends on the angle, the perspective you want to use. And sometimes one perspective it's a wave, and one perspective it's a particle. So with awareness, you can use different perspectives to understanding it. So I don't want to kind of say, you know, this is how it actually is. But that's not so important. What's important is that for Vipassana practice, that as it deepens, there's a clear awareness that there's, you know, the recognition, the knowing, which is separate from the experience, becomes stronger and stronger. So you really see the experience and you know you're seeing it. It's recognition of it. You know it's two different things. So you know that there's the hearing of the car, and you know that the knowing of that hearing is different from than the sound itself. There's, you know, the pressure of my hand against my knee. That pressure and the knowing of that pressure are two different things. And that recognizing the difference, the knowing, that capacity to know that's pressure, becomes stronger and stronger with Vipassana practice. So you know also you get more and more intimate with the pressure against the knee. You really see it and the contours and the textures and all the aspects of it. But as you do that, at some point with Vipassana practice, it's really clear also that the knowing of that pressure is different than the pressure. Is this making sense? I hope it's useful. I'm a little bit afraid in my mind that that this is not going to be useful for you. It's going to just tie you up in knots. And so, yeah.
Is it similar to explaining the difference of a place I can be in meditation where I'm breathing and I'm aware of my breathing, and there are definite differences in places where the breathing is just happening, and yes, I'm aware of it, but there's not really a thinking of it.
So she says that, you know, there's times when we're not breathing is just happening on its own, and she's not really thinking about it. I think there's breathing is just happening on its own, and you feel like you're absorbed in it, or focused, or concentrated on it. But there's not much cognition or recognition of what's going on there.
But I'm not asleep.
But no, yeah, you don't sleep when you're concentrated. You don't have to. I mean, you can't get asleep. But the with Vipassana, you would actually know. So the distinction I made earlier in the question and answer session is that, I don't know, maybe not the best analogy, but concentration, if you're looking at the snow falling down outside your windows, a big snowstorm, the snow's pouring down, and when you're concentrated, you're just kind of absorbed in the flowing, the flow, the movement of the snow falling in front of the window. You're kind of absorbed in that flow. Whereas in Vipassana practice, you'd actually focus on a particular snowflake and recognize something about the snowflake, get to know it better. So with concentrating on the breath, you're just absorbed in the breathing, and you don't really care what the sensations are like. But when you're doing Vipassana, you actually care. You want to actually get to know much better what's actually the details of that experience of breathing. So if you're breathing in, you would actually recognize that there's movement, expansion, pressure, maybe experience of tautness at the very top of the breath. You know that as you exhale, there's, if you're following at the end of the torso, be aware of the contraction, letting go, the releasing, the movement. Maybe at the very end of the exhalation, you'd wear maybe a little pull, maybe. And you'd actually know those little details. When you're doing concentration practice, you wouldn't know any of it. You're just hanging in there with the flow. Is this helpful? I'm trying to make a distinction, because I thought after these weeks of focusing on concentration, you'd like to try to clarify the distinction between them. So there is a distinction to be made. I also kept saying, I don't want to make a hard and fast distinction between concentration and mindfulness. I kind of like to think of them as kind of overlapping. Or say it this way, that you need a certain... I'm a little bit uncomfortable with... debate that sometimes exists in Theravada Buddhism between, should you do the concentration path or should you do the mindfulness path, as if they're radically separate paths. Rather, it's a discussion about the merits of the relative degree of each, because you need to have both. In order to do concentration, you need to have some modicum of mindfulness to be able to keep you on track. If you do mindfulness, you need to have some modicum of concentration, some concentration in order to keep you on track with the mindfulness. And then it's a matter of the degree. So when you do stronger concentration emphasis, you wouldn't have a lot of mindfulness. You're just focusing on developing concentration, but you need some mindfulness. And if so both are needed, and then it's a matter of which degree you have. Now, some people will develop concentration first and then switch to doing insight practice. Some people will do mindfulness practice first and then will switch to doing concentration practice for a while and then switch back to doing insight practice. There's all kinds of different ways of doing it. And some people, like in the Mahasi tradition of Burma, which is the tradition primarily that I come out of, the rhetoric is you only do mindfulness practice. But the whole context of doing the practice supports doing it with a lot of concentration. So the context supports concentration, but the rhetoric is just keep doing, working on your mindfulness. So a tremendously strong concentration builds while you're doing the mindfulness practice. So much so that the teachers in Burma talk about vipassana jhanas. That there's samatha jhanas, which are the jhanas of samadhi practice, concentration practice. And there's vipassana jhana, which is jhanas of vipassana. And the jhanic, five jhanic factors that happen in samadhi jhanas also occur when you enter into the vipassana jhanas. The difference is that there's a difference, and that is that the vipassana jhanas are not quite as intense. There's quite a level of absorption. But still, you're quite absorbed, quite involved. And the hindrances have fallen away, the mind is engaged. And rather than mind being one-pointed on one thing through time, the mind still has the ability to get one-pointed, but gets one-pointed with whatever is happening in the present moment. So, you know, mind's not scattered and wandering around, but you feel an itch, and the mind has an ability to get one-pointedly focused for, at least for a moment, on that itch. So the jhanic factor of one-pointedness is there also. The sequence of going from joy to happiness to equanimity, as you do when you go through the first four jhanas, occurs also with the vipassana jhanas. How strong, how absolute is the separation between these vipassana jhanas and samadhi jhanas? I don't know. There's in terms of the concentration jhanas, there's a range of schools. There's different schools of thought about what constitutes a jhana. And some teachers will say, only if you have these particular characteristics is it a jhana. And other teachers, no, it's different. You can have different characteristics that characterizes a jhana. They all agree that the five jhanic factors play themselves out. But then, can there be any thinking in a jhana? And some teachers say, absolutely, in jhanas there's no thinking whatsoever. And other teachers say, yeah, there can be some thinking. It's no discursive thinking. You're not kind of wandering around thinking about dinner. You know, but there can be some kind of very refined kind of thinking about what's happening in the jhana itself. Some people say in some of the jhanas, you wouldn't even be aware of what's happening. You'd only kind of be aware of what happened in the jhana when you came out of it and you reviewed it. Then you're aware. And some teachers say, no, I mean, I don't think that's a jhana at all. That's something else. But you're not even aware. In jhanas, there's always some kind of presence of mind while you're there. You wouldn't say that you weren't aware of what's happening while it's happening. So there's a wide range of what different schools of teachers say what's a jhana. And then we have this vipassana jhana also. So we have to kind of make our way through that and either decide which one is right and go along with that teacher, or we could try to figure out some other way of holding the differences. One of the ways I hold the differences, and you can go along with me if you'd like, is that each jhana can be experienced with a range of intensity. So there isn't just like one degree of intensity that's the jhana, but rather say that like each jhana can be experienced from 1 to 10 in terms of intensity. And you can experience it at a level 1 or a level 10 in terms of intensity. And all points in between are in the jhana also. And so some teachers will say, oh, it's, you know, because of their own experience perhaps, that, oh, it's mostly, you know, 1 and 2 is what I recognize as being a jhana. And other teachers say, no, it's only 9 and 10 which is jhana. And they're all right. They're all jhana. They all are within that range of intensity that allows for that jhana. Does that make sense? So that's very nice because it harmonizes everybody. I like to harmonize everything, you know, and not have people being, you know, opposed to each other. But yeah, I don't know if I'm right. I'm not really that qualified to talk about it. I've done a lot of concentration practice and have experienced a wide range of concentration states, but I haven't been formally trained in concentrations like the jhanas. So there are some teachers who actually guide people to go through the jhanas in a very organized, very systematic way and train people in the systematic approach of going through them. And I haven't had that. So, you know, if a person really wants to get trained systematically in the jhanas, you're probably better studying with someone who actually you know, has gone through the systematic training themselves. So, so you know, I'm not that qualified to, you know, to answer this question of what these different jhana teachers have to say, who are actually in the system much more than I have. In the Vipassana world, the Vipassana world of IMS and Spirit Rock, the avenue for going into the jhanas, for developing that level of concentration, is with doing metta, the Brahma Viharas. And that's usually by going on long retreats, 4, 6, 12-week retreats. And there's a fair number of people now in this insight meditation world who have developed metta practice and have, you know, and gone to, been trained systematically in the jhanas by doing metta. And it's a really fantastic, it's a phenomenal world to realize the tremendous power of the mind, how you can train the mind. And the mind is, you know, it's just a phenomenal apparatus. And people who live in kind of street consciousness can't even imagine, I think, how powerful an instrument the mind is and how it can be developed and used. And, and then there, outside of Spirit Rock, there are other teachers who teach various ways of doing the jhanas. Tanisara Bhikkhu, who comes here sometimes, has his way of approaching it, primarily through the breath. Lee Brazington, who's been here a few times, has his way, which he was trained by Ayakema. And what I haven't studied with either him or her, but how I understand it is that he uses he helps the practitioner discover some kind of pleasant sensation or pleasure in the body. And then you use that and focus on that and intensify it. And as you intensify it, then you get into the jhanas. Is that right, Cheryl? And Cheryl has studied with Lee. And then there's Bhante Gunaratana, who also is a jhana teacher in West Virginia. And there's a Westerner in Australia named Ramavamsu, who has very strong opinions about what a jhana is, and he's on the 10 on the scale. Yeah. So the other thing that's interesting about the jhanas is that these very strong states of concentration. Is that in the cosmology of Buddhism, the Buddhist idea of the cosmology of the realms of existence, the realms of life, the heavenly realms, and the realms of the world here, that it's said that the heavenly, there's 33 heavens in Buddhist cosmology, and those realms of the heavenly realms correspond, they're divided into the and there's two general categories. Let's see. I don't know if you care about this cosmology, but I wanted to make a simple point, but I feel like I have to kind of... So there's 33 heavenly realms. Those heavenly realms are divided into three different realms themselves, three different categories. There is the Loka Dhatu, which is the worldly realm. And we live in the worldly realm. Loka means the world. And there are some of the gods who live in the worldly realm. But you can't see them because they're living in a kind of up there in a little heaven. But they're considered to live in the worldly realm. And then this second heavenly realm is called the Rupa Dhatu. And the Rupa Dhatu, the consciousness of the beings in the Rupa Dhatu corresponds to the first four jhanas. So as you go up in the higher and higher realms in the Rupa Loka, Rupa Dhatu, you go from the first jhana, the second jhana, the third jhana, the fourth jhana. So there's consciousness is defined or characterized by being jhanic. And then when you go into the highest realm of gods, it's called the Arupa Dhatu. And there, their state of their consciousness is characterized by the four formless jhanas. 5 to 8. And now what's interesting, also it said that when a human being like you enters into a jhanic state, you temporarily become divine. Isn't that nice? And so the different realms of existence in Buddhism is defined by states of consciousness, and that in various ways gets embodied. It's not bodies that kind of go into different states of consciousness. It's consciousness that gets embodied, in a sense. And as you, so the arupa have no body at all. And then the rupa dhatu has kind of, I don't know, some kind of body. And then the human realm, for us, we have like solid bodies. And so, and then if you get really adept at developing these concentration states, then you're likely to get reborn in the corresponding heaven. So if you do a lot of the rupa jhanas, if you do a lot of like into the first jhana a lot, or the second, or third, or fourth, then the chances are you get reborn in that realm of the gods that characterizes their consciousness. If you spend a lot of time in the arupa loka, in the formless jhanas, then you probably get reborn in these formless realms. So how you want to understand that element of Buddhist cosmology is up to you, but the moving of consciousness between different states is something that's very clearly recognized in Buddhism, and something that Buddhist practice is helping us to do. So for concentration, for Vipassana practice, you don't need to get into, well, this is also a debate. Some people say you have to go into the jhanas in order to be able to do Vipassana. And so there's whole schools that say actually take you through certain levels of Vipassana, of jhanas, and then as you emerge, either as you emerge, some people teach you as you emerge from jhanas, you then start doing Vipassana. And some people say that within this, some of the jhanas, especially some of the lower ones, you start doing Vipassana within those. And some jhana teacher says, that's absurd. There's no way you can do Vipassana within those states because the mind is not able to do, you know, it's so concentrated. And some people say, oh yeah, you can. So I don't know if we need to go into all this, but there's a whole system, different teachers have different systems of how you switch from doing concentration to Vipassana. And there's different ways of working with that. If you feel that it's useful, and if you feel attracted to this concentration practice, I'd encourage you to continue doing this. And I think it would probably, you know, if you find it useful, if you find you have some ability to get concentrated and you get absorbed, you know, really interested in it and it's helpful in your life, develop it as far as you can. And it becomes like concentration becomes like a strength. It's a very helpful strength that you carry with you into the world. It's like you have this like really strong strength, like this solidity inside of you, in a sense. And that all the things of the world that are disturbing are going to be less disturbing because you have this pillar inside of you. You kind of have this grounding. And you don't have a lot of wisdom necessarily, but you're stable. Whereas if you don't have the strength of concentration, you're much more likely to kind of be, you know, tossed around by the world. Vipassana doesn't focus so much on the concentration stability. It focuses more on the stability that comes from wisdom and seeing and understanding. But it's really helpful to have that strength of concentration. So I'm very happy when people develop concentration. And if you feel interested in it and feel like it's helpful and you have some ability in that department, please continue, and if you stay around here, you're welcome to come and talk to me about that and how it develops and how it goes and how you might develop it some more or when you want to switch to Vipassana. Some people develop too much concentration, and then there's a whole way of working with them, or they're kind of stuck in there, they're hiding in their concentration state. And it's very pleasant, very nice, and they're just kind of always going in there, and it's not very helpful for them to always go and hide out in the concentration state. And sometimes it can be very difficult to switch to Vipassana, partly difficult because suddenly it's not so pleasant. And they don't want to, you know, why should I hang out with all this suffering when I have this pleasant place to go? But it can be kind of a dead end to spend a lot of time in the jhanas or in concentration states. At some point, you need to switch over. Yes, please.
The second factor of awakening, discernment or investigation of phenomena versus, say, concentration, which is the fifth or sixth factor, aren't they all sort of happening at the same time? You know, in the process of being with the breath or with the bodily sensations, all those factors are working.
Not necessarily. Some of the factors, seven factors of awakening, are universal. They say in the Abhidharma tradition, are universal aspects of every moment of consciousness. So there's always some concentration, and there's but it's about tranquility and investigation of dharmas. That doesn't have to be present. It doesn't have to be present when you're in the jhanas, for example, or you know, it's. So, for example, joy, which is one of the factors of awakening, is there, you know, in the first two jhanas, but that in the third jhana it falls away. So it's not necessarily, you know, the factors of awakening aren't all present necessarily just because you're present for the breathing. And in fact, I remember when I was on retreat once, and the seven factors of awakening were quite strong for me. There wasn't much happening. I was very concentrated, very still, very absorbed in my practice, and a lot of my the viveka that I talked about Monday night a few weeks ago, it was quite strong. There wasn't no experience in my physical body anymore. Body disappeared. Very little going on in the mind. Very rarefied states of consciousness, but the seven factors of awakening were quite strong. And so I went to my teacher, and I would talk about seven factors, and we'd work with him a little bit. And then after a few interviews, the teacher noticed that I would name the seven factors of awakening, but I'd always leave out equanimity. You know, I'd forgotten about equanimity. And in fact, that was the one that I needed to develop in order to bring them all into balance. Because it might have been a little bit present. So... we're running out of time here. I had something else in mind for this evening besides just talking here. And that was... I actually wanted you to talk with each other a little bit. Oh, the Metta Sutta. I forgot all about that. But I actually wanted you guys to spend a little bit of time. Maybe you can take your stuff. If you'd be patient with me. I think it's really important what this concentration class and your engagement, you're working with it, and what happened as you did it, what happened when you did the concentration practice, what happened when you heard the various teachings I had about it. And I think that if you guys have a chance to form little groups and actually talk about what that was like for yourselves and actually talk to someone about your own practice a little bit and hear how it was for other people, I think it actually might help you kind of solidify and integrate a little bit what happened here in the course. And you shouldn't feel shy. It isn't like everyone gets an A. So, you know, some people, you know, have greater abilities to get concentrated than others. And that's just different minds. It's not like they're a better person because they can get concentrated. I know people who are real jerks who have great ability to get concentrated. So, you know, and I know people who are really, you know, some of the purest, most wonderful, greatest people that I know who have, you know, really poor ability to get concentrated. So don't take it, you know, feel free to kind of say how it is for you, and you don't have to kind of be apologetic or feel, why don't you form little clusters of about five people, four or five people, and just each of you spend, you'll have about 10 minutes. So each of you has about, you know, 1 or 2 minutes, and just talk a little bit what this course was like, what this last 4 or 5 weeks have been like doing this practice, and your experiences of it. Well, the impression from looking at all you was that that was very useful. It seemed like a very nice, people, you seemed intent, and it seemed like to have so many people kind of intently talking about their practice together, I think has to be good. So I was very happy you participated in that. And I'm not sure what to say now to finish up. A couple of things. So this is the first time I've taught a class like this. And I was hoping it would be useful for people, and the impression I had, it was useful for a lot of people. And I think, and it was also very interesting for me. I felt like I learned a lot, especially learning from people who talked to me about what happened to them when they did the concentration. I felt like I learned a lot from you. And there's a wide range of how people engage in the practice, how they use it, and the benefits they get. And I felt, I kind of felt like there was a whole world open up for me of how concentration affects different people, and how different kind of benefits people get, and different ways of working with people, and different options people. It's like a whole, I felt like I was in kindergarten. And I feel like I have a lot to learn. So it was really great for me also. And what I tried to do was just kind of put out whatever I knew that I could tell you that I thought might be remotely interesting and useful for you in this regard. I've never taught a class like this before, and I've never taken a class like this before, so I don't have any models of how you're supposed to teach a class like this. But I'd like to, I'll do it again. Probably once a year we should do this. And personally, I'm looking forward to kind of learning how to do this kind of class over the... It might take 3 or 4 years to kind of... times to kind of find out how to teach a class like this well. But it was what it was, and I enjoyed it, and I hope that you did, and it was useful. And if you didn't memorize Metta Sutta, you're expected to still finish the memorization. Just because the class is over, you're not off the hook. The commitment during the class was to memorize the Metta Sutta, so you have to do that. And you can't wait until the next time we do it, because I might have you memorize something else for the next class. So any final words, any questions, anything that you feel like I should have covered, or anything that... burning questions about all this that you'd like?
One thing, Gil, you seem to be tonight discerning, referencing the difference between mindfulness and vipassana. And yeah. I think maybe you didn't know the difference.
In popular discourse, vipassana and mindfulness are considered the same. In the technical, a little bit more kind of abhidharmic kind of technical distinction, vipassana, mindfulness is a factor of the mind. It's the mind's ability to hold something in a discerning way. Vipassana is having insight. So using that mindfulness to the point of beginning to have insight into what our experience is. So until you start having insight, you're doing mindfulness. Once the insight starts coming on, then you've started doing vipassana practice. And then there's a whole progression of what happens. There can be, I don't want to say there is, but there can be a progression, or there are different levels, intensities of vipassana insights that happen. Just like there's a progression in the jhanic practice, so there's also a progression in vipassana practice, and the insights that, as they unfold. So technically, vipassana begins when the mindfulness is coupled with a strong enough concentration that you start seeing either the difference between what's called nama-rupa, which we talked about today a little bit, different between the sensation and the knowing of the sensation. Or for other people, the vipassana begins when you have a very clear insight into how things are impermanent, how your experience of things are impermanent. And that's the first. It's one of the primary insights in vipassana, is the insight into impermanence. So, when some in the Mahasi tradition, you're just told to pay attention and investigate, see clearly what's actually happening. In some other traditions where you do concentration practice first, and then you switch to Vipassana practice, you're actually directed to start looking for impermanence. Whereas in Imhansa tradition, which I'm in, you're not directed to look for anything. You're not, usually not directed to look for impermanence. But some Vipassana teachers say, okay, now start looking for impermanence, and noticing everything is impermanent. So some ways of doing Vipassana, it's much more directed. You're directed to pay attention to certain things that bring you those insights. In the tradition that I practiced in, you're not directed. And part of the reason for that, at least for one of the reasons I like to think it's the reason for that, is the mind is very suggestible. And it's very, not only suggestible, but it also has a great imaginative ability to create things. And so people can think they have this, having the insight seeing something there, but they're kind of imagining they're seeing it there. So if you don't tell them what the insights are they're supposed to have, then they can't, you know, the power of suggestion is not there, and it's, you know, you actually can be more sure that they're actually seeing it. When I, my first time I practiced in Thailand at a monastery there, there were very few Westerners there, but there was a library upstairs in the little building, and the library was all Thai books, but there was a picture of the king. I mean, a lot of the rooms in Thailand have a picture of the king, so there's a picture, the big picture of the king. And I found out just before I was leaving the monastery that all the English books were behind that picture. Because the abbot didn't want any of the Westerners to read those books. Until afterwards, after they practice for a long time, then you read it. So the one style is you practice first, and then you read the books to find out what happened to you. But you don't read the books first. So I'm a little bit more of that school. You don't read the books first. You trust the practice. And then afterwards, I'll give you the books. Afterwards, I'll tell you what happened. Yes? Well, that's a big issue, which I don't feel that qualified to answer that question, because the reason is because there's a lot of spiritual traditions and discourse which makes as the ultimate goal of the practice the dissolving of the subject-object distinction. And that's the ultimate, when there's no longer a subject-object kind of distinction. You're completely one with the experience. And is that the case in Buddhism? Some Buddhists say that, some Buddhists don't say it. Is Vipassana leading us to that? You could say that, and you could say it's not that. It depends a little bit on the perspective, how you understand, you know, the angle, like is it a wave or a particle? So, so it's a big topic that you raised. However, the interesting thing I want to leave you with, rather than answering the question, is that Buddhism doesn't always say that the ultimate way of being in the world is to dissolve that subject-object distinction, which some people consider to be the ultimate. So I'm not saying that's true, or the ultimate truth. I'm saying that to raise in all of your minds some questioning of the position that that's the goal of the practice. I don't know if that was a helpful answer, but that's the one you got.
Isn't that what anatta is, though?
Sorry?
Isn't that anatta, the dissolving of subject object?
It's a dissolving of any idea that there's a self here, watching involved. But there's still awareness and the object of awareness. So it's not a subject in terms of an I, but there's subject in terms of awareness and there's a sound and a knowing of the sound. There's no I knowing it, but there's a knowing still. Some people would say that the Nibbana is the dissolving of subject-object distinction. And that's very nice to say. It's just that there's a lot of things that don't apply in Nibbana. So, that doesn't apply either. Does that mean that it's the wonderful kind of disappearing of the subject and object in Nibbana, and you know, you could say that. Some people do say that, but, you know, there's no ice cream in Nibbana either. So, with that, one more question I want to ask you all. How, you know, this class has gone over every time, right? Today, even more than usual. What would it be like if this was a 2-hour class? Would that be okay with you? Well, some of you have left now, so you can't. But, so just next time, should I just do it, a 2-hour class?
Mm-hmm. And should it be 7:30 to 9:30
or 7 to 9? Yeah. Does 7 work, or is that a challenge? Challenge with work and stuff? Well, you got to put it in your calendar. No, this is the class I can ask. I mean, you know, otherwise, I have to. Otherwise, if I don't ask you, then I just make it up on my own.
7:30 to 9:30.
How many people want 7? If this is a class, how many people would prefer 7:30? How would it satisfy everyone if we did 7:15 to 9:15?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, so, what?
7:15s don't work in terms of attendance time. So just
because people can't track that well.
It's like bad news. Sorry.
You gotta concentrate on it.
You start at 7:17. Lock the door. We'll have to synchronize our watches. So anyway, it was really very nice for me to do this class, and I really enjoyed teaching it, and I felt stretched in trying to figure out how to teach this kind of material, and look forward to next time, and I appreciated all of you being here, and I wish you all well. Thank you.